ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
For the past 4 years, UWM scientists have been involved in one of the largest studies ever conducted into brain development of adolescents. Funded by the National Institutes of Health, the study is tracking nearly 12,000 kids across the United States, including about 400 of them right here in southeastern Wisconsin. They're trying to see how those children's brains mature. It's a fascinating story and one we've been following here on UWM Today for some time. On this edition of the program, we're going to get an update on the project from Professor Krista Lisdell. She is a professor of psychology and head of the Brain Imaging and Neuropsychology Lab at UWM's Department of Psychology. Joining her on the program is Ryan Sullivan, a doctoral student who's working closely with Krista on the project. Welcome to today's program, Krista. And Ryan, great to have you with us.
Such a pleasure to be here, Tom. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You know, I should begin by really congratulating you because you and your colleagues around the country just recently, a few months ago, got word that the project, which started 4 years ago, has just been renewed. And I think you got, what, hundreds of millions of dollars more to continue the project. Congratulations, Krista.
Thank you so much. We're just so excited to continue this work with our colleagues throughout the country to really understand lots of different factors that influence adolescent development.
You know, if I were a listener right now, I'd say, well, you're studying brains, but people have been studying brains for generations. Why this big monumental project looking specifically at the brains of young people? Aren't all brains alike?
Well, you know, the adolescent period is a fascinating period of ongoing, very dynamic neurodevelopment that's continuing. It's different than childhood and it's different than adulthood. And I really view it as this golden gateway into adulthood, this kind of last big chance to intervene and really change the trajectories of development for our youth. And, you know, as a professor and scientist and mom, I think that this is one of the most important investments we could make as a society. You know, what are the internal and environmental and family factors that we can influence to really harness this developmental period and have just the highest functioning, healthiest group of adolescents that the United States have ever seen?
So the study itself, let's go back and take a look at what started 4 years ago. It's not just UWM looking at the state of brains in young people, but there are researchers across the country doing the same thing, right?
Yeah, this is truly a big science moment. So we have hundreds of colleagues throughout the country, including a coordinating center and data center at the University of California, San Diego. So these hundreds of scientists have come together to really implement the most advanced state of the science protocol that we can to understand social, emotional, physical, and neurocognitive development.
And Ryan, as a doctoral student, you're right in the heart of this research. Tell us about your involvement and how people like you, just beginning your career in neurosciences, got interested in the project in the first place.
Yeah, it's a really interesting project to really be a part of because I'm working both on the end of data collection, meeting with some of our families that are here in the community, and then also getting a chance to really work with the data on the back end. And so it gives us a really unique opportunity to look at this development across the adolescence period, where a lot of our studies haven't had this chance to measure the same subjects, you know, repeatedly through time. And so this has given me a really unique opportunity to work with a large diversity of investigators across the country and just get introduced to a lot of new perspectives.
Well, you said something really importantly, looking at these students over a period of time. That's how this study is different from a lot of other previous brain studies, right? Because what you're tracking the same 12,000 or so kids, not just for a year or two, but for what, up to a decade?
Yes, up to a decade. So we enrolled them when they were about 9 or 10, and we're planning on following them for at least 10 more years going forward.
Wow. So Krista, as we think about the research that has been done over the last 4 years, probably really helpful for our listeners to give them a sense of exactly how you're going about the answering the questions of how these young brains are developing. You're talking to a lot of these kids, but not just the kids, you're talking to families too.
Yeah, great question. So this is the first few years of this was really dedicated to collecting and enrolling families throughout the country. So nearly 12,000 families, and we see them every year. Every other year, they get a state of the science brain imaging scan. So we get to really see closely how the brain is developing in this trajectory from 9-10 to about 19-20. On top of that, we have cognitive testing, all sorts of questionnaires about their mental health functioning. We look at physical health as well, their relationships with peers and families, and also the relationship with their schools and their perceptions of their neighborhood, things like neighborhood safety, poverty levels, things like that. So we have this very detailed protocol that involves lots of different experts. And we measure this every year moving forward, right? So for at least a decade. So we want to know all these different factors that influence, again, their physical health, their mental health, as well as their neurocognitive health from ages 9-10 to 19-20, with really the hope that we would follow them even into the early 20s. And so this takes this collaborative effort to make sure that we give the same protocol to all the families across the country. We also put a lot of effort into making sure that it was a really nice, diverse, representative sample. That's one way that this is different from some of the prior research, where we really have a very diverse group of kids and families from all over the country. So we can really tease apart, you know, cultural influences and geographic and environmental influences on adolescent health.
So is the physical brain, does it develop differently in part depending on what neighborhood a kid is living in?
Well, that's one of the things that we really want to investigate. In fact, one of my colleagues, Elizabeth Soul, from LA, just looked at the influence, for example, of whether or not you live in a neighborhood that has high lead levels, and whether that's related to any of the neurocognitive outcomes. So this study really goes beyond a lot of the smaller neuroscience studies where we're just kind of looking at the brain and maybe a little bit of some psychological questionnaires. And it starts asking bigger questions that can really influence policy. Like, what is the neighborhood like? What's the quality of education the kids are being exposed to, as well as their family dynamics, genetics, and their own individual biology?
Ryan, you mentioned before that you're involved in data collection and really trying to put your hands into the evidence that is being gathered here. Let's talk a little bit about the interviews, the conversations that you have with the children. 9-10 years old, how do you get kids to open up? How do you know that they're being, quite honestly, honest in their responses?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. As serving as a graduate student on this project, I primarily work with the parents as they are a very integral part of our study. We have a lot of really well-trained staff that deal with the kiddos throughout their assessments with us. And they get a chance to really give some well-validated measures with our youth in the study and ask them all sorts of different types of questions, as long as having some very objective measures of these variables that we're interested in looking at, like Krista had mentioned, with some of the neuroimaging and the neurocognitive that involve more of that end as well, too.
So you need to make sure you're selecting children and parents who are willing to be forthcoming about what's really going on in their life then, right?
Yeah, I think that's what we were looking for with our recruitment.
Okay. Now, Krista, I'd like you to talk about the neuroimaging that you said is taking place. What you said, every other year, you're going to be essentially taking pictures of the brain itself. First of all, how do you do that? I mean, thousands of participants. Are you putting them in MRIs? What sort of equipment is being used to actually look in the brains?
Yeah, we are using MRIs to get pictures of the brain structure, as well as what their brain is doing at rest and how different parts of the brain are communicating as they're just kind of thinking and relaxing and engaging in different tasks, such as problem solving or memory, or even kind of making decisions. We also have some really cool imaging that gets at almost the molecular level of white matter, which is the quality of the connections between neurons. So we have this very advanced neuroimaging, and that's done in collaboration with the Medical College of Wisconsin and some of our great collaborators, such as Dr. Andrew Nenka.
So I know it's early on. You've spent the first couple of years, as you said, lining up the participants and beginning the survey work. Is the idea that as you move through the future years of surveying these kids, you'll be, for example, will you ask them the same question when they're 13 that you ask them when they're 10, and what you're going to see how the brain fires? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, you got it, Tom. I'm going to enroll you in the study.
I want somebody to look up there because my wife has a lot of questions of what's going on upstairs.
Yeah, so there was a lot of planning that went into this. We have a lot of different assessment groups and expertise groups, but we created a protocol that we will be giving in a repeated basis over time so that we can really measure changes in things, like changes in sleep quality, or changes in screen time activities or media usage, or whether or not these adolescents are engaging more or less in physical activity. And we can see how these different health behaviors, as well as their mental health, such as symptoms of depression or symptoms of attention deficits, hyperactivity syndrome, how these things over time relate to neurocognitive outcomes and vice versa.
Ryan, let's talk about your specific interest in this study. You, as I understand it, are indeed focused in part on the physical changes in the brain. Tell us what you're doing on that front.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So firstly, what I've done is looked at a little bit of work here at UWM of data that Krista has collected previously, and a team of us working with her, including Dr. Tasha Wade, who's over at University of California, San Diego, Dr. Ann Swartz, who's here at UWM, and then Alexander Wallace and I with Dr. Lizdahl have really gotten an opportunity to look at, objective measures of aerobic fitness and exercise and what that looks like and how it interacts with the brain. And so we've seen some positive outcomes with that associated with neurocognition and then also brain structure, which is what I'm particularly interested in. And so this fuels a lot of questions going forward, thinking about, how I might apply this to the ABCD study and think about, how I can think about, this aspect of exercise and also potentially the influence of substance use as the youth in our study start to get older and their brain starts to mature a little bit. So it presents a really unique opportunity for me to answer some of these really pressing questions that we have.
Krista, it's got to be exciting for you as a faculty member, as a professor, to have somebody like Ryan in your laboratory who can help push the science forward.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, thank goodness for graduate students, right? So, they are the ones that bring in the creativity and the new energy, and they're the ones that are digging deep and learning this big data analysis techniques that are very challenging and really require a lot of collaboration. So folks like Ryan and the other graduate students are really key members of the lab and the study.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in our remote studios in this age of COVID today are Krista Lizdahl. She's a professor of psychology at UWM's College of Letters and Science, and Ryan Sullivan, a doctoral student in the clinical psychology program, working hand in hand with Krista on a project called the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Project. It's ABCD for short, and it's an amazing study with 12,000 students or so, young people around the country, being studied by psychologists like Krista and Ryan to see how their brains mature as they grow from preteen into the teen years. Let's talk, Krista, if we could, about the ways in which sometimes kids don't take care of their brain. I know that a lot of your research, in addition to this particular project, has looked at, for example, the use of marijuana. How does the use of a drug like marijuana impact brain development? That's one of the questions that you're posing in this study challenging yourself to look at how these young people's brains are impacted by the use of cannabis, right?
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of my work to date for about the past 20 years have looked at the effects of repeated substance use, especially marijuana or cannabis, on the brain. And through a series of studies, including one of Ryan's most recent publications, we've seen that repeated cannabis use is related to some abnormalities in brain structure and cognition. And these tend to be fairly subtle differences, but they can relate to everyday problems in attention, processing speed, memory, as well as some symptoms of mental health problems, such as sleep problems or depressive symptoms. One of the big questions, though, with this research has been, is that because they were at risk for using cannabis, or is it for sure caused by cannabis? And we really can't answer that unless we've measured people repeatedly before they've ever tried cannabis, right? So one of the things that I've been looking at is the substance use patterns in these young people. So again, these at baseline, their age is about 9 to 11. And the good news is, overall, there's very little, like very, very little substance use experimentation in this age group. Indeed, we really only see some alcohol sipping and then extremely rare experimentation with a little bit of nicotine or cannabis.
So essentially, you've got a blank canvas that you're looking at. So you is that where you begin to then piece together how the environmental factors or history of the family, their medical background might have an impact on brain development?
Exactly. So at this baseline level, again, they're only about 22% have had a sip of alcohol, for example. They're typically sipping beer or wine. And usually they're getting it from their parents. About 80% are getting it from their parents.
That's still kind of concerning, though, at age 9 or 10 to be sipping that early.
Yeah, you know, so it's a double-edged sword a little bit, right? So on one hand, there's very little substance use. I think there was about, there were 81 kids of about the 12,000 who had tried a nicotine, mostly vaping nicotine product, as young as 9 to 11. And there were 12 kids that had already tried cannabis. So there is a little bit of experimentation happening. And if we dig in a little bit to the alcohol sipping, some of our colleagues, including Ashley Watts and Dr. Ken Shear, looked at predictors or associations with this early sipping and did find that the alcohol sippers were more likely to have a mood disorder, were higher in impulsivity, and also externalizing or kind of fun-seeking, sensation-seeking type characteristics. And you know what? These are risk factors that we see down the line have been related to increased risky drinking in adolescence. So we are seeing a little bit of a risk early on, and it's really made us think about, you know, what is the advice, you know, to parents or other people in very young folks, like even 9 to 12 or so.
Any evidence of whether or not the impact of early use of alcohol or early use of cannabis, is that with them forever? Or do you think the study might show that if you stop using drugs or alcohol as you get into your mid-teens or later teens, not that that's likely, but if you did, would that impact or negative impact go away?
Oh, yeah, that's one of our major questions. What we know so far is that even early sipping alcohol behavior at 9, 10 can lead to, other research have found that it leads to more risky drinking at ages 14, 15. And if people have this early onset of risky drinking, they are more likely to develop an alcohol use disorder in adulthood. So we do need to track that and dig into that. And what I'm really interested in are the resilience or protective factors, okay? Hey, I'm a mom of a 12-year-old, and I have nephews that are in this, you know, adolescent range and other kids that I care about a lot. So I'm very interested in what protects them from going down that path. And if they do go down that path and we correct it and they stop using, do they recover completely and get back on the trajectory they were on? Or is there some more longer lasting neurocognitive or mental health consequences?
Ryan, I understand that one of your interests is looking at how exercise might impact those young brains if kids do start drinking or smoking early. Tell us about that.
Yeah, no, that's been one of my big focuses coming into graduate school and working with Dr. Liz Dahl, who does take a more health psychology approach to some of these questions. And so some of our research that we previously have found is that, you know, exercise and engaging in aerobic exercise gives your brain an opportunity to engage in some of the mechanisms and chemicals that are released to really promote your overall brain health. And so what we found is that even in people who engage in substance use, those who are higher fit do show better neurocognitive outcomes compared to those who are lower fit. So that's another interesting question that I'm hoping to explore with ABCD and kind of take that role of how exercise may vary across adolescents along with some of their substance use that they're engaging in and see what sort of interplay that has on the brain.
Boy, those answers could be incredibly important to a parent who wakes up one day and discovers that they have a kid who does have a problem with drugs or alcohol, right?
Yeah, we've thought a lot about that, that could this be used as a prevention strategy? Yeah. You know, do we need to be engaging in more physical activity and really just more physical health initiatives with our youth to make sure that they have the healthiest brains and they're as resilient as possible to some of these influences?
Krista, I understand in this age of COVID, one of the things you began looking at this summer is the impact of the pandemic on brain development. What's happening with your research on that front?
Yeah, along with some colleagues such as Susan Tapert out at UCSD, we actually started a COVID-19 sub-study. We realized really quickly as the pandemic was progressing that there's a few different ways this could affect people, right? So our lives have changed. Right now, I'm sitting in my kitchen instead of the beautiful studio downtown. You know, how does this social isolation affect our mental and physical health? There's been changes in people's employment. There's been changes in child's, you know, daily lives, how they're engaging with school, how much screen time they have, how close their relationships are with others. So we've started a survey, a monthly survey with the ABCD enrollees, where we can kind of look at shifts in mental health, screen time, sleep, school engagement, as well as relationships with family over time on a monthly basis during the pandemic. The other thing is that if a child does develop COVID-19 infection, we can see if there were changes in their brain, cognition, physical health, or mental health due to that infection over time.
Boy, that is so important. Such a great question to be asking in your research, because you hear stories today of adults who have what they call the COVID brain or COVID fog, people who you know, get knocked out mentally, sometimes more so than physically. So knowing what's going on with kids has got to be a critical issue for us, because they're going to be around a lot longer than we are.
Right, right. Yeah, we're very concerned, you know, at the field of neuroscience and neuropsychology is very concerned about any sort of short and long-term effects of COVID on brain function, perhaps due to inflammatory storm, you know, that's being experienced in the body. So we can look at some of those mechanisms in children that are enrolled in the ABCD study.
Ryan, I've got to ask you this question. You're a young doctoral student. You know, you've got your whole career ahead of you. This is an amazing opportunity that you've got right now to be involved in what will be the largest study in this country ever, looking at young brain development. Do you think this is an area you're going to spend the rest of your career in, or is this just a launching pad for something else? Where do you see yourself going?
Yeah, I think that that's a great point. I think that, you know, our field is really moving towards this sort of framework with big science or big data in mind. And so I really feel myself falling into this sort of realm of, you know, thinking about these large sorts of data sets and answering some of these questions with these big interdisciplinary teams and, you know, really taking on the role as a clinical researcher going forward and scientists to really answer some of these questions. And then also take a lot of that opportunity and a lot of the data that we are finding and then disseminating all this back to the community and into the hands of the people that really need it, like our educators, our medical professionals, and even our parents too. And so, you know, this wouldn't be done without the many thanks to them.
It's like a kid in a candy store. You're not sure where to start in terms of your next projects, right?
Most certainly.
Krista, as you take a look at the future of your research, you've got funding now. Is the recent, nearly $300 million in new federal funding, will that be enough for you to finish the next 6 years of the study so that you get the full 10-year snapshot? Or
yes.
Is there going to be a stopping point along the way?
That'll bring us to 10 years, Tom, and it's been tremendously successful thus far, and so I am very optimistic that we'll get funding so that we can follow this cohort into age 25, 30, which I think will be very important, actually.
Yeah, so maybe in another 6 years, you'll be asking for a little more support to again, look at how these people become young adults and then mature adults.
You can count on it, Tom.
Great. Well, fascinating story. I'm so glad, Krista and Ryan, that you could join us to give us this update on the project. And to our listeners, we will have Krista and hopefully Ryan back. I know that graduate students tend to go on and get great jobs after UWM, but maybe we'll see if we could put a little ankle bracelet on you to keep you here for a while. But we'd love to continue to get updates on what you're discovering, because now comes the really exciting part of this science, doesn't it?
Yes. Lots of studies are coming out, so we will be back on soon.
Terrific. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Krista Lisdell, Professor of Psychology, and Ryan Sullivan, doctoral student in UWM's Clinical Psychology Program, talking about the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study, the ABCD, a 10-year look at how young brains develop among American youth. Well, that's all for this week's program. As usual, thanks for taking some time to learn about the tremendous work and interesting work that our scientists and researchers are engaged in at UWM. Remember, you could listen to this program and any of the other programs we've done recently. Just go to the WUWM.com website and look for the UWM Today program listing under programs, and you'll see a catalog of links to some of the great interviews we've done previously. Take care, everybody. We'll see you next week at the same time. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.